Hello, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, with an interview in December of 2025. And I think this is a particularly interesting one. So grab a seat and lend me your ears. You're going to get quite a lot out of this if you are at all interested in or familiar with my recent Solutions Watch video, introducing people, perhaps for the first time, maybe not the first time, to the philosophy of liberty. So first things first, if you didn't catch that recent edition of Solutions Watch, long story short, that was a video that was simply encouraging you to watch another video, specifically a video called The Philosophy of Liberty. That will, of course, be linked up in the show notes for this interview. In case you haven't seen it yet, it is 8 minutes long or 8 minutes short and is, I think, required viewing for every human being on the planet. Luckily, that video, although it is obviously primarily and first and foremost was in English, it has now been translated into dozens and dozens of languages. So there is no excuse for anyone on the planet not to have seen and imbibed that video, The Philosophy of Liberty. That is the number one message. But if you have seen that video, and if you are at all interested in the background of that video, where did this flash animation come from? How did it emerge on the internet a couple of decades ago? And how did it, through at the very least influencing me to start the Corbett Report, thereby influence perhaps you and other people out there who have benefited from my work over the years. If you're interested in that story, this is the interview for you. So to set the table, every 2 weeks, as you know, I'm on the Declare Your Independence radio broadcast with Ernest Hancock. And this week, both of us were talking to Ken Skuland, who is a retired, now retired, professor of economics, upon whose book, Jonathan Gullible, the Philosophy of Liberty video was based, or it sprung from that book. If you're interested in that story, it is an interesting story about how the Jonathan Gullible book came about in the first place, how its publication in the newly liberated post-Soviet Russia led to the development of an introduction that became the basis, at least for the script of the Philosophy of Liberty video. We talk about who was the actual person, the animator behind the person who made that into an animation, etc. I think it's an interesting story, and hopefully it gets to the fundamental point that the philosophy of liberty is, in fact, at base, pretty simple, and it can be demonstrated in just a few minutes of pretty simple and straightforward introductory text. And if you're interested, there's much more behind it. And people can go, for example, and read the Jonathan Gullible book, exceptionally easily readable and easy to digest. And it's another tool that people can use to unlock minds of statists and those who refuse to relinquish their belief in the most dangerous superstition. But if you're interested in any of that, I think you should watch this interview. And of course, if you are interested in this emerging campaign to try to get this video, the Philosophy of Liberty video, back in front of the public's attention at a time when I think they could highly benefit from it, well, we have some things to say about that too. So strap in, listen to this conversation. I hope you benefit from it, and I'll have more to say about this topic and hopefully more conversations with Ken Skuland in the future. But here we go.
This is what we're going to do. We're going to be talking to James Corbett, of course, and then we're bringing in Ken Skuland. Now, Ken Skuland, we've known for a long time. This is one of the OGs, even before me, and I'm an old guy, before we started, you know, promoting libertarianism. I even knew, you know, Ken was around doing it for a long time. This is what we're going to be talking about. This is a mile marker event in freedom activism for around the world, okay? We'll own something and be happy. So what we're going to do is going to talk about the philosophy of liberty. Now, the philosophy of liberty had a beginning. It was generated into a video, and we'll talk about that. I'm going to have Ken tell us the whole story. We'll do that first, so Ken can tell us where this came from. Many, millions, billions, gazillions have seen philosophy of liberty. It's been it's 8 minutes. It's been translated into 46 plus languages. Now, during Arab Spring, it wasn't translated into Arabic. So talked to Ken about it. We got together and found a guy in Moscow that, you know, for $1,000, and I think we each paid a third, or was a third person, I can't remember. And we have for $1,000, we got it translated into Arabic. We sent thousands of the DVDs in the PAL format so they could play it in the Middle East, because it's different there, because fortunately we knew that. So we sent thousands of them to Alexandria. Alexandria activists took them to Tahrir Square when, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood jumped in front of their parade and said, vote for us kind of stuff. And we knew during Arab Spring, this is all about, you don't need Pharaoh number 283. You know, what you need is freedom. So we had it translated into Arabic, dumped it there, and it exploded. It went Morocco, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, you know, Northern Africa, everywhere. It was just a thing. Well, it caused some DDoS attack. Mossad through Germany came after us. We went, fortunately, my IT guy at the time is also an attorney. And he tracked it back, sent a letter, kind of go, oh, we're ever so sorry. We were just showing you your vulnerabilities, signed Ivan. I mean, you know, this is how bad this is going to get. So we're going to be putting this in all the languages in IPFS, have the links and embeds and everything ready to go on sites all over. The Liberty community is wide and deep all around the world. Now, Students for Liberty is already committed to be involved. The Arizona Project, which used to be Language of Liberty, where they select a bunch of, you know, 6 to 9 young adults that come here from around the world, Nepal, Ecuador, Ukraine, Russia, Japan, Africa, I mean, everywhere, comes to Arizona, and they all got to go shooting, man. They like that shooting thing. So they come in, and I interview them, and I do individually every year for the past, God, many years, 6, 7, 8 years, I don't know, a long time. And now one of the students started running it. Well, he is now president of Liberty International, which used to be International Society for Individual Liberty. And then, this is right after the Arab Spring stuff was going on, that ISIS, Obama started referring to it as ISIL. Well, that's their initial on their webpage was ISIL. So they start getting hacked and everything. So they got to change it to Liberty International. Yeah, that's the ticket. And I'm going, this subtly and from perpendicular but relevant directions, it's attacked. And the reason is because it demonstrates the morality of liberty. You own yourself. Now, we're going to have you guys, you can go watch it on your own, and you'll be encouraged after this show. It's been a long time. In the 90s, we used it as activists here in Arizona, and we just put it everywhere. I knew that that was going. Now, when I interview everybody, I go, why did you read this? Who encouraged you? Why do you even care about freedom? Was it your grandma, your mom, your dad, your teacher, a coach, an employer, an uncle? I mean, who is it? And it always comes down. I keep digging enough. Yeah, but why did you do that? But what? Well, there was this little animation philosophy of liberty thing. Aha! And that happened to James, too. So when I was talking to the young man from Uganda just a few weeks ago, and he I did the same thing. Well, it came to this, to this, to this, the professor, that guy. Philosophy of liberty. And I go, man, that thing needs to get resurrected. So I called Ken and I said, will you come on, tell us the history of it, get involved with it, Liberty International, and Yasek, that's now president, Ken stepped down to be VP, let the next generation come and take it. Well, I know Yasek well. Well, Liberty International, Students for Liberty, James Corbett, Freedom's Phoenix, we are going to make it happen. And with Derek's help, with the IPFS, this is going to be a thing. It's going to be decentralized. Not any one person is going to get super credit for anything, whatever, and that's not the point. How many minds can we free again? So that's what we're doing. Before we get to Ken, James, tell us your experience with that. That kind of surprised me. That kind of got you on the road. Tell Ken what happened.
All right. So to the best of my memory, and this was something the better part of 2 decades ago, so I'll just have to go off of hazy memory. But I do remember that time that I wrote about in the opening essay to my reportage book. I was in 2006, basically falling down the internet rabbit hole and discovering all sorts of information that had been deliberately occluded from my indoctrination back in my Canadian schooling days, including, of course, political philosophy, real political philosophy and economics and the foundations of human liberty had been almost completely kept from me during that time. Although I do remember taking, I think it was high school level social studies class, and we were just looking at some political philosophy. And I remember reading just a passage or even just a summary of John Locke and going, well, you know, that sounds about right. But I didn't put that much thought into it at the time. It just kind of corresponded. Yeah, okay, we have the liberty to do what we want as long as that liberty isn't infringing on other people's liberty. Yeah, okay, that seems about right. But it wasn't until this time in 2006 or maybe early 2007 when I was casting about widely online and looking at all of this information from different perspectives, and I came across this very simple, very direct, 8-minute long flash animation, The Philosophy of Liberty. And I remember encountering that, and I remember being struck by its simplicity. It leads inexorably from one very simple and basic observation to another, towards a totalizing philosophy of political philosophy, essentially. This, it all made sense to me almost intuitively. It wasn't really persuading me of anything. It was just showing me, in a way, what I think I already intuitively understood. But it was putting it in a way, in such a simple way, a straightforward way that really resonated with me. And I suppose there are two ways to think of it. Either one, I didn't exactly have a penny drop moment that suddenly freed my mind, but this might have been the beginning of the snowball rolling downhill. The other way to think about it, maybe this was the penny drop moment, but it took a long time for the penny to fall down and to finally reach its goal. But at any rate, something about this video resonated with me and did set me along the path to what I am today. So to what extent the Corbett Report has resonated with others, and that to whatever extent my attempts to foster this message of liberty have reached others, it is at least in some part due to this video.
Ken, tell us everything, man, from the beginning. You know, one thing that I did, I looked at it. I go to AI. I ask Grok. I ask, you know, Google. I go into, oh, yeah, that's, you know, we got record of like 2013. And I go, no, it was earlier than that. Okay, maybe 2007. There was, you know, I go, no, we used that long. So obviously they scrubbed, they don't like it. It's not there or something. So I need to know how this came about. What started it? What was it gleaned from? And it always comes back to Ken Skulin. So tell us everything.
Well, I got to tell you, James, you really warmed my heart to say that about it, because I you know, it always feels good to know that what you've been doing has impact, and I can't tell you, it really makes me feel good about that. Years ago, in about 1980, I was invited by the Libertarian Party of Hawaii to write commentaries on an all-news business radio station at 90 seconds, just direct commentaries about issues, and nobody was paying much attention to those commentaries. Nobody wants to hear an economist talking about the days of the issues just in a straight manner. So I wrote it into a dialogue, The Adventures of Jonathan Gulliver, which paralleled The Little Prince and Gulliver's Travels, some simple books that had very profound messages in very entertaining way. And the humor and satire of it picked up a lot of interest. And then finally, Small Business Hawaii decided to put it together into all the episodes into a book, which first got published in 1989. Then because of my affiliation with Liberty International and meeting with all these people from other countries, I was there because I wanted to spread libertarian ideas to other countries. And the first edition was published in the Netherlands. But the very second edition, I was excited about. I had been to St. Petersburg right after the fall of the Iron Curtain. I met up with Dmitry Kostigin.
Okay, the publication of what? Is this Jonathan Gulliver you're talking about?
Publication of Jonathan Gulliver.
Okay, now wait. You got to tell us what Jonathan Gulliver is, man.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a sort of a fanciful story that's now in 58 languages. We've had it in Farsi in Iran, Asante in Ghana, the Arabic one that you mentioned in Jordan, a Chinese edition, actually a multitude of editions all over the world have been published from this.
Well, tell us about Jonathan Gulliver, you know, what it's about. That was the spark of everything, man. You're killing me. All right, go.
Okay, the story is something like Gulliver's Travels, in that a kid gets tossed about by a storm and winds up on a strange island. And then he has these adventures on these islands, basically running into foolish behavior of people. People who have to knock down trees with sticks because they got to save jobs. If they allow a hatchet, that's going to destroy jobs. So the tall tax that forces everybody to walk on their knees because it's unfair for some people to be taller than others. Lots of 40 episodes altogether in the book that point out the folly of stupid government policies, and that the ethical issues behind this all the time. And so it's a fanciful story that popularizes ideas from Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek, Ayn Rand, Friedrich Bastiat, Murray Rothbard, the economic free market world of the day, and puts these into stories that are fun and entertaining. Well, the guy in Russia that was actually first just a tour guide, now he's a billionaire in the grocery business. He met me, giving me a tour around St. Petersburg, and he liked the idea of Jonathan Gulliver. We had lots of discussions about it too, and he had just read Rand, and so he said he would publish the book. But he needed for me an introduction, because people in Russia didn't know anything about what property and taxes were. I mean, the government had owned everything. Whatever you produced belonged to the government. They gave you something back. And so they didn't understand property and taxes. So that's when I decided to write The Philosophy of Liberty, which at first was the introduction to the Russian edition. But because it was so well received, it became the epilogue of every other edition after that, the other 58 languages. And so then the book was very popular behind the Iron Curtain. It got picked up in all the Eastern European countries. And then it was the first free market book in China, Vietnam, Iran, Russia, Kyrgyzstan. I mean, they even made plays about it in Kyrgyzstan for elementary school kids. They took selected chapters and portrayed the free market ideas. It's been produced as a play in Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, Brazil, Slovakia, all the high schools in Slovakia. And now it's been featured on the Free to Choose Network in the first season of the animation cartoon that's been produced from the book. So,
What year was this? When did this all come about?
The book was first published by Small Business Hawaii in 1989, and then it was published in the Soviet Union about 1992, 93.
Wow!
Since then.
Let's get a little bit even before that. The ability for you to even write this was because you're an economics professor.
Yeah.
You know, let's talk about that. I mean, you graduate. When did you start being a professor?
I started teaching up in Alaska in 1975, 50 years ago, and I just now retired after 50 years of teaching. I had been working as an international economist in Washington, D.C., White House, Commerce Department, International Trade Commission, and I got disgusted with bureaucracy and decided to go to Alaska and get away from it all and just teach instead. But I was frustrated the fact that most people had horrible experiences with economics. It was something dry and boring, and textbooks were awful. So I thought, well, there's no reason it should be that way. It should be fun and interesting. So I produced this book to make it popularize the ideas of all these free market thinkers, you know. And there are characters in the book now, too, by the way. The cat in the book is Mises, the cat. And the Bard of Roth is a famous character. And they go to the Mount Hayek, and they meet Milton and Rose talking with their son Davy about economics concepts. So they're woven in throughout the book to make it. I think I'm the only Austrian economist in the Pacific region here, I think. By Austrian economics, you know, I'm referring.
Well, certainly then.
You know, this is economics.
Okay, now there was we knew of you through the 90s, but when I made use of your stuff, it was when I started doing radio on Terran Radio here out of Scottsdale. And what happened was you had public service announcements that you had done for radio stations in Hawaii that I used. You know, we had every day or hour I'd play one of these. Where did that come from? Talk about that. How the hell did you get on, you know, FCC radio? You know, explain that.
Well, it was KHVH, which is now it's a talk radio show. But at that time, it was an all news business radio station, and they allowed, as part of their public service, they allowed community organizations to come on and give 90-second radio spots once a week. And so I was invited, or that was the Libertarian Party of Hawaii wanted to have their spot in there, and I took over from another guy and started doing these weekly commentaries. But it allowed me to make a story form out of it, which was fun. I did a dialogue with a girlfriend that I had at the time, and so you have different voices, and I had to write into it humor and satire, which got a kick because people, they recognized how it related to the folly of the government policies. In fact, everywhere I go, like in Poland, they say, how long were you living in Poland that you understood all of the foolish policies of the day? And I said, oh, I never lived in Poland, but these follies are universal for governments.
Yeah, government's government.
Everywhere.
So this is, you start to see it expand. When did International Society for Individual Liberty, now Liberty International, when did that start, and how did that get incorporated into their activities?
They actually started up in Canada. I think it was in Montreal that Liberty International started off as Libertarian International, with Vince Edwards and Bruce Evoy, and then they moved to Richmond, Virginia, and they combined with Students for Individual Liberty, and they combined to make ISIL, the International Society for Individual Liberty. I joined them in the early 80s because I thought that libertarian ideas were doing well in the United States, but I thought the ideas should be spread abroad. And they were doing ideas of promoting the distribution of pamphlets and literature to other countries. So I wanted to get involved with them and go to their conferences. And then because I had this book out, then it was a natural to, and a lot of people liked the idea that it was a short book, a brief book that could readily be translated and used in student programs, student seminars, radio. I mean, it's been we did radio dialogues that you used on your program, and I think there are several countries that have done radio. Nepal has used radio. A lot of magazines. The first serialization of it was the Hong Kong Economic Journal. I mean, this is the intellectual journal of the business community in Hong Kong in 1997 that serialized it because they said, well, soon China's going to be watching what we do, and they're going to have to be a little more cautious. So they went to satire. And that's the great thing about satire and this youth type of story. It gets around the censors. That's why the mullahs approved it in Iran, and that's why the Chinese authorities, you know, that all the publishing houses in China are owned by the government, but they've published two editions of the book saying, oh, it's just a children's story. But they don't understand the message behind it. And that's why, I mean, in Kyrgyzstan, they made all these plays out of it that are totally contrary to the Marxist philosophy. And you get all these kids cheering on this condemnation. Just, for example, the idea that, well, if everyone's from each according to ability and to each according to need, well, suppose we hand out grades from each according to ability and to each according to need. All right. Everybody the worst grade if they're a good student, and the best grade if they're the worst student. I mean, if they're the worst student. And the students say, that's not fair. That's terrible. Even the teachers are laughing about it because it would be folly to do that thing in the classroom, which is Marxist philosophy. So you get the Marxists all around the world embracing this idea that challenges their own ideas.
Can I just chime in? That is so much in resonance with everything that I have discovered in two decades of doing my work, is that satire tends to be the way to disarm people from their intellectual defenses against things they would otherwise not be willing to entertain. And I've found that time and time again, and it's no surprise to me, because by far and away the most viral thing that I have ever done is a short little 5-minute satirical video that's lampooning the official government story of what happened on 9/11. And for whatever reason, people laugh at it and they enjoy it, even though it might go directly against what they actually believe. But they are imbibing the information in a way that gets past those intellectual defenses.
One of my favorite books is Hammer and Tickle, Jokes That Brought Down the Soviet Union. And what we really understand from that is that tyrants can punish and deal with people that are arguing against them, but they have no argument against mockery and laughter. When people laugh at them, they hate that the most, because it undermines their authority and they lose face. That's why they used to send people off to the gulag for 15 years for telling a joke, 10 years for laughing at the joke, and 5 years for not reporting a joke. Because tyranny was, laughter was such an affront to tyrants. They didn't know how to deal with it. They're too serious.
Yeah, I apologize. I'm trying to get the studio in one of the boxes, but whatever. As long as they can see both of you guys, don't matter. The one thing that I wanted to make sure is that the professorship that you did in Hawaii, was your libertarian philosophy supported there? Were you under constant attack? I got 10 years since I've been here longer than you. I mean, you know, what is the your experience as a professor there with the administration?
I never taught at a government school, and I never taught at a school that offered tenure. And I've never had any issue with the faculty. For one thing, the president of the university, Hawaii Pacific University, actually, he met me in the hall and he says, you know, I support everything you say, except maybe on foreign policy or something, you know. There was always something that kept him from identifying with the libertarian philosophy. But I'd say that they all knew who I was, because I was very public about it, ran for office 3 times as a libertarian. So there was on the radio as representing the party, even on public radio station, giving commentaries for them for a couple years too, you know, as the Libertarian Party representative. And they were always very respectful. I never had any issue where anyone gave me any trouble because of my libertarian philosophy. I think the way I stated things was in a way that they have to say, oh, well, that makes sense. You know, whether they're left wing or right.
What?
They just said, okay, well, that makes sense.
I think that really resonates through all the way to the Philosophy of Liberty video, because again, I think it's just simple statements that most people would agree with, and that leads to another statement that they would agree with, that leads to, and suddenly they find, wait, actually, do I agree with this? And as long as you don't use that dreaded label, libertarian, oh my God, all the baggage associated with it, then I think most people would be willing to go along with at least much of that. But it does raise the question, where did you come from, as it were? How did you discover, how did you get into this? Where did you go for yourself, for your undergrad, for your graduate degree?
As you can see, I'm quite old. I was born in 1949 when the Chinese Communist country took over. And my earliest political memory was of the Kennedy-Nixon debates. And I remember asking my mom, what's the difference between Democrats and Republicans? She said, well, you know, one party wants to have the government run your life and the other party wants you to run your own life. And then later I found out that both parties wanted that same thing. Mm-hmm. But it set out this contrast. And so throughout my college years, I was very fond. I was drawn to Milton Friedman and then Murray Rothbard, Ayn Rand, and ultimately, Friedrich Bastiat and the other Austrian school stuff. There wasn't a Libertarian Party when I was in government. It had just been born in 1971, and their first election was 72. And I left and went to Alaska in 1975. But I I discovered the Libertarian Party when I was traveling through Hawaii. I met Roger McBride, and I became a real hardcore devotee of libertarian philosophy. And I'd say that those were the origins. My school was Georgetown University, an American university, and Occidental College. Learned a little bit, studied a little bit in France. But mostly it was, I never had a teacher. My first economics teacher was sort of free market, but there wasn't an Austrian school that was known by almost anybody in those days. In fact,
well, what brought you down that path? I ask everybody that. Why? Why were you this way? What grandma, what mom, what dad, what coach, what something? What took you to even see liberty as a solution?
I think the seed was during the Cold War. My mom was quite she took me to hear one of big speech when I was a kid was at the state fairgrounds to hear Herbert Philbrick, who was the guy I led three lives about being a double agent between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And I guess I was quite concerned. Stalin was such a murderous monster, and I feared that sort of thing could spread to other places around the world. And my wife is from China. I was drawn to her because she survived the Cultural Revolution by rebelling. Her father, a surgeon, had been put in prison, and the whole family, her mother, an English professor, her whole family had been exiled to the southern provinces for 10 years. I identified, long before I even met with her, I identified with the tortures of tyranny, like Solzhenitsyn and his Gulag Archipelago. Those are things that just ate at me. And I thought, this is the path that any country can take. Because I always felt that freedom and liberty is a very, very fragile thing in society and civilization. That you constantly have to be on guard. And how terrible it would be if you say, oh, I let it all happen and I didn't do anything. I'd feel horrific if I hadn't been a part of trying to resist that. And I guess that's been my path all throughout my life, resisting, I guess, this communist notion. But it's all around us. It's not just from communist nations.
Yeah, I got a bunch of other questions and so on, but I want James to interview you a little bit. And a lot of this stuff, you know, we've talked many times. We've had shows together and stuff. A lot of this stuff I didn't know. James, what is it you want to know, man?
Well, I'd like to hear some of the experiences of some of the people that you've met along the way. And I guess you were operating and around at the time where, for example, Murray Rothbard was still operating and around. Did you get a chance to meet him or any of the other big names?
I did meet him once. And I went to a seminar in Eugene, Oregon, where the Cato Institute was holding a whole bunch of seminars with Ronald Hamowy and Leonard Liggio, some of the big names of that era and so on. I remember very vividly this interview. This journalist wanted to interview Murray Rothbard about the CIA's help of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. This was back in 1980. And the journalist was saying, aren't you excited that the United States is helping the Afghanis to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan? And he said, no, the United States shouldn't be in there. That's his voice and all. And the journalist was shocked. Well, why not? How do you know that the guys taking over aren't going to be worse than the guys that they're getting rid of? And that's exactly what happened. I just spoke with some of my Afghani friends up in Toronto at a conference that they've got up there, the World Anti-Extremism Network, which is a great organization. And they said, the Mujahideen were worse than the communists because they gave way to the Al Qaeda and the Taliban, which were terrible for human rights. As bad as the Soviets were, the Taliban turned out to be worse. So I'd say Murray Rothbard was proven right long after his passing. So he was one character. I met also with had dinner once with Harry Brown at one of the Freedom Fest events. Harry Brown, when I was sitting at the table, this one guy came up to me and says, you wrote this book, How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. And in your book, you say, stay out of politics. And he said, that was the first part, but you didn't read the rest of the sentence. It says, unless you're having fun. Yeah, I'm fortunate to have encountered some of these icons of the Liberty movement.
Well, tell me the longevity of the philosophy of Liberty. Has that surprised you, the impact? Like when we did the Arab Spring thing in Egypt, you know, like, damn, Ernie, what the hell did you do? I mean, you know, this is, but there's been lots of times that kind of thing has sparked something from that video. Talk about some of the other times and that time.
Well, James Corbett really did it beautifully by saying that it made an impact on him. I've had people over the years say that it really made an impact, and a lot of websites have wanted to feature it on their website too, and so it's gotten a lot of, early on I used to follow the metrics, you know, and I noticed that I was excited to see where the downloads were coming, because they were coming from countries all around the world, and it was most in the United States, but all around. I mean, during Arab Spring in Saudi Arabia and Jordan and those places, and I was delighted to see that, because it made me feel like if they're downloading it and watching it, then that means that they're excited by the message. And so, yeah, I am astounded, because when I wrote it out, actually, I was taking ideas that I had gleaned from Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman and Murray Rothbard, actually, and putting them together. Actually, I think I contributed one new element, this about life, liberty, and property being elements of future, present, and past.
I like it.
But the rest of it was, you know, derived from the shoulders that we stand on. And I have to really give tribute to Kerry Pearson, the guy who asked me, hey, this is really good. I want to put it on animation. Now, this is in 1994 or so.
Now, is he known by Lux Luger? Is that the same guy?
He's Lux Luger.
Okay, now, why? Tell us about him. You know, I didn't have the pleasure to meet him. I just remember after he was helping with the radio show at one time, he passed away from complications of diabetes or something. And I don't know how old he was. I don't know what his history was. I don't know what his skills were. You know, let's give him some props here. You know, a little bit about Lux.
He was a young guy, younger than me. I met him through Liberty International, because we had conferences. The idea was to have international. At first, it was between the U.S. and Europe, and then we got more international, and then it was in a different country all around the world. So now we've had something like 48 conferences. 40 conferences all around the planet. The last one was with Javier Milei down in Argentina, Buenos Aires.
Okay.
And I met him at one of those conferences. He's kind of a quiet, shy guy, a computer geek, which, you know, in the early 90s, they were all libertarians, because the logic of the libertarian philosophy just fit naturally with computer geeks. But as a geek, he wasn't real sociable and all, but he liked this. He wanted to put it in animation. He said, but I don't have the money for the software for that. So I gave him $150, which was big money in those days for some software to make this animation. And then he produced it in English, Spanish, French, and Portuguese, I think. And so then he came to our conference in Puerto Vallarta and featured it for the first time, or maybe it was in Merida, Mexico, and featured it for the first time, and we gave him a big tribute. But then soon after, his diabetes, I guess, was not controlled, and he passed away just suddenly one weekend. He lived in Port Townsend, Washington State, and that was sad. But since then, we've had a number of people like Steve Cobb and others that said, "Well, we'll take this same thing and we'll just start adding more and more languages." And so now, as you mentioned at the beginning of this show, it's 46 languages now, and we can still do it. AI makes it really easy to do this sort of thing, but not necessarily for backward languages. You know, most of these the Arabic language, you have to read it backwards, and it's a different technique for a lot of these languages.
Well, Ken, you point out that you weren't exactly reinventing the wheel here. A lot of this comes from people who have talked about this for many years. But don't sell yourself short. The past, present, future being tied to life and liberty and property is actually a brilliant way of framing that. And that was one of the first things that struck me when I first watched that. I'd never thought of it that way. Lay that out for the audience who hasn't yet watched the video and where that idea came from.
Thanks so much, James. Yeah, I remember just I was on walks and I kept thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it. And I don't know what sort of clicked with me when I realized that, well, you know, we always talk about life, liberty, and property. That's with from John Locke. And I thought, well, how can I relate this to our existence? Well, in time, you know, our life is our future. We have a whole future ahead of us. If they take our life, well, then it's gone. We have no future. So to take that is murder. Okay. Well, what about our present? Well, that's our actions today. That's our liberty. Okay. Life and liberty. And how does the past fit in? Well, we spend a lot of time in the past producing our product. It's not the whole of our past, but it is a product of our past. When we produce wealth, we earn savings. And if the government takes our savings or takes our property, they're taking that time that. And when the thief comes up and puts his gun to our head and says, your money or your life, we're just calculating, well, I'll give him my money, which is a product of my past, because I keep my present and future so I can replace it. And that's why we give over our money instead of our life when faced with that dilemma. And I had to write it carefully as not to say that it was the whole of our past, but taking our life is the whole of our future. there's nothing more if you take that. So yeah, I had fun putting that into a concept, which I wrote out in some kind of paper or something like that. But this was the way to express it in the simplest way. Because so the Russians, they had no concept of property and taxes, and they needed an explanation. And how often do you get an opportunity like that to explain?
Now, here in America, to anybody under 40?
You know,
this is
the point. It's maybe this is a way for people can apply this to whatever they're working on. Try to explain this to someone who has never even heard of the concepts, the basic grounding of the concepts that you're talking about. Try to explain it at the simplest level possible. And this something like this might result.
I'm just now reading a book called The Courage to Die by Yoon-Yi Park, a girl who escaped from North Korea, and she's writing out this book about what it was like to be in South Korea then when she did escape, and everything was so new. Things that we take for granted are just such basic concepts of life and expression, and I'm living that. It actually brings me to tears to see what the revelations are for someone who has never had freedom to suddenly have it. And of course, it makes us appreciate all the more having freedom, the things we take for granted, because it's all around us all the time. We don't really appreciate it so much. And there are a lot.
I want to ask you this. There's a, you know, timing thing. Like now it's really needed for this fundamental basic moral understanding and the benefits of self-ownership and freedom and not being told what to do all the time. You know, getting a permission slip from the crown kind of crap. Was that kind of the feeling that all this was born in? Then we started getting a little better, and then it started. You see a need for its resurrection.
Well, yes, I think that it's often for God. I'm not one of these people who say these are the worst of times. We never had this so bad, because every generation thinks that they're having the worst of times, and the things are so complicated compared to what they were comfortable with before. But yes, I mean, I just finished teaching 50 years, and I'd have to say the classes of students that I were having are extremely naive about the world, and their education seems to be poorer and poorer, which I attribute a lot to government schools that have no interest in this kind of history. I mean, like when I showed people the Soviet story, how the millions of people died in the Soviet Union or something like that. This is all completely new to them. The whole Cold War that we lived through oh, the Cold War, that was something past. It doesn't have any relevance to us. But, I mean, the whole of the 20th century was a struggle for a battle of millions of dying in so many stupid ways, too. And, yeah, I'd say that it's important for young people to be shown what it was like not to have freedom or to be in the constant war or to have depression or whatever, you know.
Were you popular as a professor? Did the students like you or they protesting you?
No, I'd have to say I was well received. I mean, you know, I had two clubs on campus. One was an entrepreneurship club, how to start businesses, and another one called the Reason Club. Sometimes they changed the name to the Laissez-Faire Society. But it was always packed with students who got to talk about, well, basically free market ideas. I didn't use the word libertarian on campus because I didn't want it to be just a partisan thing. But they knew they were there because they were learning about free markets and always had speakers in or films, or they got to give presentations about things that struck them the most. And I'd say that, and I got Teacher of the Year Award 3 times. So, I'd say that I was well received by the students. Yeah. I mean, to boast about my own self and be immodest. Yeah, sure. I'd like that.
Yeah. But, God damn, freaking man. I don't care. You know, you're going to have to do it. You know, how impressed are you with his lineage and history there, James?
Very impressed. Obviously, again, just that concept of tying life, liberty, and property to future, present, past.
I use that all the time.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And it's such a great way of framing that. That, again, I think most people will be able to intuitively understand, even if they hadn't thought of it in that way before. It does, of course, raise the question of what are the issues today and how do they apply? How would Jonathan Gullible, for example, talk about, I don't know, Trump's tariffs or something along those lines?
I've got a couple chapters in there about tariffs and the broken window fallacy. I mean, the broken window, and I mean, not the broken window, but also the window tax, because the candle makers petition that Friedrich Bastiat talked about. You guys know that the candle makers and coat makers don't want all this free light and heat from the sun. We got to have jobs, create jobs. So we had people board up their windows with a window tax so that that's one of the chapters in there.
They can't do that now, so they tax the sun.
And then another one with the bridge coming into the town. You know, Friedrich Bastiat also made fun about how the prosperous cities aren't the ones way up on the mountaintop that it's hard to get to. They were the ones down at the mouth of the river that was easy to get to. And so what if a city in Stolta and Puera, I found out the two cities that he wrote about, Friedrich Bastiat, is the Latin for silly girl, Stolta and Puera. And Puera put all these boulders on the inside, on the side of the bridge where people were coming in, and they could leave freely. But then Puera was wondering, well, should we put boulders on the other side of the bridge to retaliate against them for doing this? And he pointed out the folly, the stupid thing. It hurts innocent people and creates a great burden. Yes, there are always special interests that benefit, but at great expense to the general public. So, yeah, I mean, I don't say Trump's tariffs. I never mention. In fact, that's why I set the book back in old times, because I want people to think of the concept and not relate it to a particular person or event today, because that will become dated. If you start talking about Nixon, then people will think, oh, it's no longer relevant.
What I want to do is I'm going to go ahead and go through the concept of what we think we are going to do, because this is it. From listening to Ken, you can see how powerful it is, that it had an influence on. Now we got the Corbett Report, so there's that. So this is something that I want to make sure that we all understand. I've done thousands and thousands of hours of show. Since 2003, I did 5 days a week, 3 hours a day for, God, a decade and a half or something. Now we do probably, that many a week. But I always asked why they cared. Why did they go? What sparked it? And the philosophy of liberty came up a lot, less of late, but enough, and certainly people around the world that bring this up. And when James said, yeah, I, you know, I, yeah, that kind of solidified it for me. I knew I was something. And you have a 32-year-old from Uganda, and, you know, and people in, you know, young girl in Nepal, and I'm going, whoa, this needs to be resurrected. So this is what we're doing. Now,
Can I just mention that guy in Uganda that you interviewed, John Mugapi Socrates? He named his, I'm proud to say, he named his son after me, Miguel Mugapi Skuland.
Score. Man, this is what I'm talking about. All right. So this is what I want to show you. Here we have, James and I came up with the idea, and we promoted it about a year and a half ago, open source education. Now, when you go to open source education, you can see that it's James, you know, I call him Professor Corbett. I mean, because damn, I don't care. He's professing liberty. He can do whatever. He can, professor. Now, he started opensourceeducation.online as a way to combat the censorship. When you talk, you go Federal Reserve, you're a junior high kid or something, boom, century of enslavement would come up. Enslave me, yeah, same thing. So you have century of enslavement, and it's an awesome video explaining the Federal Reserve.
Well, these are yours, James?
That's right, yeah. That was a documentary I did in 2014.
My gosh, I have been following you. I just didn't.
There you go.
And then all of his stuff on, you know, one of the things I wanted to make sure that we got on, he started psychology now. And that is kind of along the lines of what we're talking about now. It's, you know, it's a philosophical, it's a moral argument. And he's done shows on that. So he, you know, curates them here. You can go find out what's up there. Then we wanted to make sure you get on history. Well, history, you have World War One conspiracy, you know, how and why big oil conquered the world. You know, so many things. You go to CorbettReport.com and you find, you get an edumacation, a real education from Professor Corbett. Now, what we were encouraging this and heavily promoted this because I knew that these videos had the same impact as your 8 minutes, you know, and sometimes they need a longer form. But we want to resurrect this. So Century of Enslavement is just a great example of how this works. Now, the philosophy of liberty, we have it all over Freedom's Phoenix. We even got its own category. And then when we put up, you know, it'll go here and it'll have his video and then the translations and all the 15 gazillion ones here. So we already have the sources for us to do this. Then we go into, you got Liberty International. They got people all over the country. And that's one other thing I wanted to ask you. Jacek, one of the young men, you know, he married one of the other students from Poland. He's from Poland. And, you know, Marta, they got married. We've been really good friends. We've supported, you know, a lot of the stuff that they're doing. And now he's president of Liberty International. And you stepped down to VP, so you're retired and kind of on vacation. But so I want to know, Jacek, coming from this, now Liberty International, I just call Jacek and say, hey, man, you going to support Philosophy of Liberty? I just wondered, you know, what do you think?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm sure that they would. They're developing a whole animation team to take up projects. Not only are they doing the Jonathan Gullible book, but they're doing a film of Anthem with Leonard Reed. They're working with him to do iSmartphone.
iPencil?
Well, iSmartphone.
Great.
Updated.
My audience is sick to death of me talking about iPencil because I think it really is one of the greatest essays ever written.
Well,
so
there's
we need
Leonard
an update,
Reed and there's Lawrence Reed. Lawrence is who you're talking about, right?
Lawrence Reed, yeah.
Yeah. Lawrence is head of, help me out.
FEE, Foundation for Economic Education.
Yeah.
Right. He's no longer, he retired from it, but he's still active with things. He spoke.
Yeah, he's definitely on my speed dial on this thing too. Okay, so what we're anticipating is that we're going to, you know, and we have other people also, like, you know, here. Let me show you. It's Movimiento Libertario, it's a Movimiento Libertario, libertarian movement. Alessandro Fasilo. Do you know Alessandro? You know, he's
I don't know him, no.
He's an attorney that has offices in Berlin, Madrid, and Rome. I mean, he's a big guy. And he's spoken at, he's visited here, Arizona. We got to hang. He's a speaker at Anarchapoco. And he just, I really pushed a lot of the stuff that he was doing during COVID. He was the only attorney that was defending restaurants that wouldn't close and so on. He's like, nope. So he has a big movement. And he is just, you know, kicking butt. There's Alessandro there. And he is just... kicking butt, definitely want to get him on. He speaks a gazillion languages as well, and he's always in part with this. Now, we have the editorial director of Students for Liberty that came and was at Arizona with the Arizona Project kids there at a supper club that I belong to, and he was one of the speakers. I talked to him about this. What shocked me is that he hasn't seen Philosophy of Liberty. You didn't know anything about it. Well, I go, you will, and here we go. We're going to expect you to put it on front page. And you tell Jacek the number one video, whatever they're doing intro, is Philosophy of Liberty. You can just tell them that. You know, Ernie said, I'll be talking to him. So this is what we're going to do, is to make it to where it can't be censored anymore. That we have James Corbett is worth a gazillion hits right there. Whatever we can do, what Liberty International does, Students for Liberty, you know, Young Americans, you know, for Liberty. I mean, all of these organizations, we need to do what we did with Arab Spring. Arab Spring happened. This is, let me just tell that story real quick. Arab Spring was going on in, I think it was Tunisia or something. A guy just couldn't get a permit to sell fruit and support his family. He goes to get the permit and keep going. Finally, he gets in. They kick him out, close the door. He goes, sits down, lights himself on fire. That was the beginning of Arab Spring. And it went all over. So what happens? Iran shuts down Twitter and Facebook. You get all kinds of censorship. You're not allowed. So when Tahrir Square was in uproar, and here came, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood, and they jumped in front of their parade, but it was an organic thing. And I'm going, I know what they need. They need Philosophy of Liberty. So I contacted Ken, and that's one question that James and I had. Who has the original animation that you can change the text on it? You know, we want to make sure that's included so people can, you know, do their own translation in case Navajo hasn't been done. I mean, damn, you got everything. But, you know, what happens is we wanted to make sure that they just had knowledge of the Philosophy of Liberty. It's about self-ownership. When that happened, I remember talking to you, go, damn, Ernie, what happened? What was the impact of the Arabic version of that? Do you remember?
Well, it did spread quite a lot, especially in Egypt, like you mentioned, in Tahrir Square, because Noua El Harmouzi from Morocco and his Lamp of Liberty affiliate to Cato Institute in Morocco was the one that was promoting it. He had classes, he was a professor, and he had seminars where he was promoting it, but also he took it to Egypt and to a number of other places in the Middle East.
This has been...
We take credit for the entire Arab Spring, of course. You know.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, well, the point that I'm making is that just like you, being there, advocating for this, doing what you can, out of Hawaii, isolated the most remote point on the planet. I'm going, holy crap. And from there, springs liberty. So I wanted to... You know, I've been looking for a moral... I'm tired of metrics because I know they're all controlled. You know, James is a perfect example of this. There was one that he just did. I think it was that version or it was a recent video in the last couple of weeks that I go to YouTube, put the exact title as it is on YouTube. He went back on the YouTube and we started, you know, loading up the YouTube again. Everybody, I don't care. Screw them. But what happened was... I put in the exact verbiage for that video, and it didn't come up. I'm going, man, that's some shadow banning right there. So this is something that I'm not looking for metrics. I'm not looking for, you know, laying hands on some the Crown says and whatever, and Javier Milei has the link printed on his T-shirt or anything. I don't care. I want to make sure that we get this spread as widely as possible because it's such a great introduction to the philosophy of liberty. Now, real quick, you know, we focused on the past, present, future, you know, by the liberty aspects of that. Talk about that a little bit. And what do you think the main message? Because the main one is philosophy of liberty is self-ownership. They had a big couple of hundred thousand Hispanics descended on the state capitol here in Arizona. It was in opposition to SB 1080. It was an anti-immigrant thing, you know, over a decade ago and so on. And I knew what to do. One of the guys that was a liaison to, he had an office in the Arizona State Capitol representing the governor of Sonora, Mexico, that he used to babysit when he was young. I mean, he knew him. So he and his family owned a series of banks in Mexico, and they nationalized them. So he and his family were stripped of everything. He moved to Tucson. He was up here in Phoenix for a while. We became friends. He wrote a lot for Freedom's Phoenix. Now, we took and did these green and red cards that had La Filosofía de la Libertad, you know, the philosophy of liberty in Spanish. And it said on that business-sized card a message from the representative of the governor of Sonora. We had tens of thousands of them. People were just taking them and flinging them out. We didn't even have to pass them out. They were doing it for us. And this hundreds of thousands of people there got this, and it was put on by the Democrats. Of course, they wanted them to vote for them. And, man, they did not like it. Governor Napolitano, which later became Homeland Security and, one of them, she freaked. And she goes, I want him fired. He's not a conservative. He goes, no, I'm libertarian. Screw you. You know? So he was told he had to apologize. No, I'm not doing it. Fire me. I don't give a crap. You know? So this is the impact that I have seen it happen. The Hispanic community, the Arab speaking community. We have, of course, everybody else. So I know. I don't think I know. Barry gets mad when I say that. I don't think I know. I know. I'm a street activist. We've been doing it. So what we're going to do is we're going to promote this thing internationally. I'm going to try and, you know, get a bunch of Kens and James and Ernies out there to start, you know, pumping it, and it'll go everywhere. And we already have the material. What is the supporting material behind it? What is it? You know, one of the things is the raw animation without the words that we could, you know, get in some, oh my God, language that hasn't been done. Who has all these files? Do you know?
Yes. Steve Corbett. I'm sorry. Not you.
What? Who?
Steve Cobb is the guy who always takes the language. He sends the template out to the person who wants to put it into a new language. And with the template, you see the English, and then you just fill in the blanks. And then he processes it. It doesn't take very long, and it's pretty not very complicated. But he's been doing this for years. I haven't been in much contact with him recently because we haven't been translating more languages for quite a long time. And then AI is changing things, I'm sure. But anyway, he's still the one that would do it.
Well, tell me about
this. And how do people get in touch with him? Where is he again?
Well, through me, but I mean, I'd be glad to look up and send you his email address. I just sent him an email. I went to that contact that we had years ago, Ernie, and I sent it out to him, but his email has changed. So I can look up the new email address and I can give you that. That's not a problem. And also, yep. I think I probably have him in connection with Facebook. But I'm not adept at Instagram, but that's where all the young people are. I'm still an old dinosaur on Facebook. But and I'm sure James
TikTok. I think that's where the kids are. Imagine a TikTok of this video.
You know, my wife, My wife doesn't want me to get on TikTok because she was, you know, concerned about the Chinese government and all that.
Yeah. And plus, it is brain rot. But other than that,
if you go to jonathangullible.com, you can see all the languages. They're right there.
Yeah.
You know, and we published all this, you know, boom. So this is a thing. And I'm telling you, we're going to make it a bigger thing. We're going to rethink it, you know. Now, before you go, I wanted to still get a little bit more on Lux. What was his real name?
Steve Cobb.
Now, no, Lux Luker. What was his?
Kerry Pearson.
And what was his motivation? You? I mean, that he did all this work and helped us.
Yeah. For one thing, he was a computer geek and he liked this new concept of making animation. You know, over the years, there have been a lot of people that wanted to make a cartoon or animation out of Jonathan Gullible, and I've not been very smart with these things. We've had some flops, but he was the first. He wanted to make some animation, and I guess we just met at Liberty International, and he was a nice guy. I mean, I can't say that I really got to know him all that well, but he was one of these guys that wanted to do his part on promoting Liberty, and he thought this
it is part. Any, before we go, anything else, James, that you want to clarify? Are you in?
We're yes, going to do this? Absolutely. But you raise a good point there, Ernie, about the shadow banning and the other nonsense that goes on these algorithmically determined platforms. So we have to find the way around that. And the only real way around that is word of mouth. It has to come from people spreading this to their friends directly. And so I want to put the appeal out. Yeah, we're going to do what we can. And we're, you know, organizations are going to be working on this, etc. But it's going to depend on the people out there who are listening to this conversation. If you have watched The Philosophy of Liberty, if you like it, then please help to spread it. It won't happen without your support because exactly as Ernie says, I mean, back in the day, a decade or so ago, if you typed Federal Reserve into the YouTube search engine, you would get my documentary, First Result, The Century of Enslavement. But once that became well known and people started finding out, oh my God, what is YouTube serving people? Yeah, they algorithmically censored it so that it became almost impossible to search through YouTube. And if and when, you know, The Philosophy of Liberty takes off and there's all sorts of people looking for it, you know they're going to try the same types of shenanigans. Absolutely. So the only way around that right now is to literally spread this to people you know. And I want to call on people to help do that.
Well, we're going to go ahead and make to where we have a IPFS version of it and a list to where people can go there and it never be gone in every language. I already talked to Derek about it. He's like, I'm down, man. We're going to make it happen. So we're going to go a slow burn on this. We got holidays coming up and everything, which is fine. But it needs to be done now. And the reason is because things are going to crap. I mean, just saying. I mean, you know, just, you know, we're out occupying the land here it's a slow burn. It's one of those things that just, you know, builds on itself and people once they become aware of it and they can have access to it and it doesn't get deplatformed or censored or, you know, taken down or whatever, you know, we're going to go ahead and provide that opportunity to make sure that these links are always good. It happens all the time. I would put stuff up on Freedom's Phoenix. We've been doing Freedom's Phoenix since 2005. And I'll put something like, you know, Century of Enslavement or The Power of Nightmares or there was another one the BBC did I thought was really good. Century of the Self or something like that. And they kept taking them down. Those links, they put them back up, but the links were always bad. So I'm going, nope. We're going to include on our web pages an access to an interplanetary file sharing link that will never go down. And this is what our contribution is to make sure that this lives, that it's accessible, that it can always be viewed in every language that we have a translation for. And if you speak something other than the 46 languages that it let us know, we'll take care of business. So this is so, I'm excited by this. And I don't get excited. I'll go a decade before I'll just all in on a project like this. And I've had at least three or four times that I've used this as a project, and it always bears big, giant fruit. and I want to make sure, and James is going to be a big part of this with his open source education, Corbett Report, our Freedoms Phoenix, the show, Liberty International. The president now is a good friend, Yasik, young man that, you know, got inspired by a lot of this stuff, and now he's president of Liberty International. And got Students for Liberty. We got all these organizations, and Ken knows many more around the world. When my family travels around the world, like my youngest daughter, a senior in school, she goes to Europe. I call Ken, hey, man, hook me up. I need some European guys that, you know, she has a get-out-of-jail card number to call something, you know, so that I just doing dad thing, making sure she has somebody. He'd hook me up. It'd be guy that owns hotels in Athens or whatever. People that, you know, in Germany. We have, I mean, it is so widespread. And the fact that we're doing this in honor of Lux, of Ken, of our efforts, it's going to be a thing. I know it. And I don't give a shit what the metrics say. Just telling you, okay? So I'm sorry, did I say that out loud? So yeah, I want to make sure people know that I already know. How'd you know, Ernie? How'd you not know? What the hell were you paying attention to? Watch it. The Philosophy of Liberty, in your favorite language, and I'll tell you, it's so simple, so basic, and so based on truth. We can go on forever, and I know James has got to go, but I just wanted to do this show to get the history behind it and who was the genesis of it. It was Ken. Ken, will you help us out, you know, when we need it?
Yeah, of course, of course. And I've got to thank you, Ernie, for introducing me to James Corbett, too, because I've been watching his stuff, but I never became a regular, but now I'm thrilled. I didn't put it all together. And so, you're a hero in my view, James. I really appreciate the stuff you did about the Federal Reserve and these other things. I'm eager to be a follower. If you'd put in your chat the link where I can find your website and all that, I'll be a regular follower.
Awesome. I will absolutely do that. We will definitely connect in the future.
Good, good, good. Great. Great.
CorbettReport.com, 2 T's.
Okay.
I'm telling you, man, this has been, it's just the beginning. And this is our Christmas present or whatever, Kwanzaa present, Hanukkah present, whatever the hell, you know, I don't care. Merry Christmas. So I want to make sure that this is a gift to the world. It's just what is the answer. Freedom's the answer. What's the freaking question? This is the whole point, you know, and you've had such an impact on myself and so many other people. Thank you, Ken. I'm glad that as you're retiring, you thought you were going to be, you know, retired and on vacation.
We keep pulling him back in.
We pull you back in, you know.
Before, yeah. And I'm very glad to be a part of this, Ernie. I can't thank you enough for revitalizing this whole project and keeping it alive. And you can count me out on anything that you're doing. I'm really pleased. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. James, any final words?
Just once again, thank you for doing what you did. And now I thank in advance the audience for helping to spread this even further. Let's take it viral.
Great, 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 great.
And it's in every language. Ooh! Oh, thank you very much. Peace, everybody.